will raise a will.
Okay, we're set. I will open the Senate Committee on Rules for May 12, 2009. And I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2621. Representative Roblin, will you please come forward? For the sake of the audience, what we will be doing is various members that have other assignments come forward. I will be opening and closing hearings, and then I will be coming back to reopen the hearings on those bills once we get through all the members that want to testify. Senator Roblin, or Representative Roblin, don't tell Senator Verger about my mistake there.
Okay.
Just proceed at your leisure and identify yourself for the record.
For the record, my name is Arnie Roblin. I'm a state representative from House District 9, and I'm pleased to sit here before the esteemed Rules Committee in the Senate to talk to you about House Bill 2621. This bill came to me through my county clerk, and after I talked to a number of other clerks, it was clear that this is a problem that is not unique to Coos County, but currently, we have two different dates at which we send out our mail ballots. One is 45 days prior to the election to overseas ballot recipients, and the other is 30 days prior to the election that we send out to our local people here in the state. The rules are clear that if a person is withdrawn or dies before the 30th date, that we have to reprint the ballots or at least strike out their name and then send them out. The problem that took place in Coos County, we had a tragic motorcycle accident with a circuit court judge who was on the ballot who died between those two dates. And so they asked what they needed to do, and the answer was, you need to take all the ballots you have and strike the name of that person off the ballot before you mail them in the county election, and you need to go and put a whole other set of ballots and mail them to the people you mailed overseas with the corrected ballot in it. And so it became clear to me when we talked to some Washington County and other people that it even gets more difficult in some of these other places, that if it was close enough to that 30-day deadline and you're in the queue basically to get your ballots mailed out, you might have to take them all back, open up envelopes that have already been stuffed, do all your changes, and then hope that you can meet the deadline of getting it out 15 days before. And so the solution seemed to make the dates line up so that it would be 47 days, which gives them 2 days before the actual ballots have to be mailed to the overseas ballotees. So what this bill does is it makes a correction to allowing that if anything were to happen, it's 47 days prior to the election, which makes sure that in both those cases, we don't have to reprint and do all the other kinds of procedures that are now in place for anybody that happened to have a tragic accident between the two dates. So that's the essence of the bill. Any questions? I would be glad to answer.
Any questions for Representative Roblin? Okay. Do we have anyone else signed up for this bill? Okay. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2621. Representative Roblin, before you leave, can I ask a question?
Sure.
Did you want to stay to testify on 2386? Or I could simply reopen that hearing right now and allow you to testify now, and then I'll go to 2414 and then back to 2386.
I'm okay. I think there's enough people here that can testify. And 2386 is which one?
Is the electronic voter registration.
I would be glad to testify on that one. It's one of the bills that I really appreciate having worked with.
Okay.
So if you would, I would be glad to.
Okay. Not to make this any more confusing to people, but it's not that confusing to me. I'm going to open a public hearing on 2386. If you'd like to identify yourself again for the record.
Representative Arnie Roblin, House District 9. I live in Coos Bay. So again, thank you for the opportunity to talk on this, I think, one of the more important bills of this session. The opportunity to have online voter registration. We spent a lot of time in the House with the Secretary of State making sure that we could make this a bill that has the security built in. Having our driver's licenses now confirmed, there are ways in which they can confirm if you have a driver's license or if you went and got an identification there. We would have your signature online. This bill allows those things to be collected by the Secretary of State so they can verify signatures. And I believe it sets in place the next generation, getting us to have people who have the right, who are Oregon citizens, who are here and wish to vote, more opportunity to be able to register. I think it helps, especially for those young people who are in and out of, who are in college and moving back and forth, to go online and change their registration so that they can and continue to vote. If you get people voting early, they stay with the system their whole lives. I think that's very important. And having three children, one of whom is in that, the 24-year-old group that lives with the electronic stuff of today, it is clear to me that online voter registration is the way to go if we want to include and keep people engaged in the process. So I hope that you look at this one sincerely. I saw that it had a ways and means referral, which I think if you listen to the Secretary of State and other, you'll find that there really is no cost to the state for this one. There are other ways to pay for it, and you might be able to remove that, but that'll be up to you guys and this side to decide how you want to do that. I think it's a great bill. Hopefully you'll hear a lot of great testimony. I see the people who came and testified in our committee on this bill, and I think you will be impressed with the work that's been done.
Okay. So thanks. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Roblin. Any questions? Okay. Hearing done. I'll close the hearing on 2386. I'm actually going to reopen the hearing on 2621 because there was a late person to sign up. Ms. Coleman, could you come forward from the county clerks and speak to 2621? And then I will go back to 2414.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, I'm Jan Coleman. I'm with the Oregon Association of County Clerks. Representative Roblin explained the bill very well. We're just trying to move the date back a little bit for a candidate who actually either is disqualified or dies or something of that sort from 30 days to 47 days. So that we aren't impacted by having to correct mountains of ballots. As he stated, in Coos and Curry counties, they had a circuit court judge who was killed in a motorcycle accident, and Coos County had to basically line out the judge's name on their ballots, about 40,000 ballots. So this would save the taxpayers some money. Because our first mailing date is the 45th day for the overseas and the military. Actually, the 29th day is when we do to the out-of-state, and the 14th to the 18th day is when we do the bulk of the ballots. But many of the counties, such as Washington County, have their ballots inserted early because they have to arrange and stack counties with the company that does that. And so if they were to wait to the 30th day and have this happen, they'd have to unseal and reseal and so forth. So this is why we're looking to move this date.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions for Ms. Coleman? Thank you very much for coming here today. I will close the public hearing on 2621. Audience, I was basically trying to just close out at least one of these bills today. And now I will open a public hearing on 2414. I have, Senator Morse, Senator Monroe, Representative Berger, and then I will start going to the other parties that have signed up also. And probably Representative Smith is probably here for one of these too. Okay. Please choose amongst yourselves, and one of you start and identify yourself for the record.
Age before beauty. I'm Senator Rod Monroe, Senate District 24 in Multnomah County and portions of North Clackamas County. House Bill 2414 is one that I strongly support. It's a pretty simple bill. Simply says that a person who is nominated for office by more than one political party can have listed by their name on the ballot up to three political parties that have endorsed them. It's that simple. It's not true fusion voting, but it simply gives individuals an opportunity and gives those political parties that may choose to nominate a candidate from another political party the opportunity to be mentioned in the voter's pamphlet. It's a simple bill. I hope you'll support it. It's also supported by the Secretary of State, State Treasurer, and the Labor Commissioner.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Monroe. Representative Berger.
For the record, Vicki Berger, State Representative, District 20. It also, I might add, allows you to refuse to have a party's name next to yours on the ballot, which is also an important consideration because it may not look too good if, for instance, I was endorsed by the Wingnut Party or the whatever. I don't know. It's not yours. I think that my reason for supporting this is based on the fact that we are all aware that there's an awful lot of Oregonians who do not identify themselves with the traditional parties, the Republicans and the Democrats specifically, and that's a growing number, and they are in some sense disenfranchised by a two-party system. What I think this bill offers is a way of people to know more about candidates on ballots than they currently do in a way that serves everyone. In other words, those of us who are elected officials and do not want some identification can refuse it. If we do want some identification, it can be put before the voters at an important time. It's a great bill to help get people more involved and help the electorate to be more connected to our system. That's why I'm supporting it. I hope you will, too. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Berger. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Chair Devlin. excuse me. And committee members, for the record, Frank Morris, District 8, Albany Corvallis. My comments will be very brief and pretty much echo my colleagues here at the table. My conviction for this bill comes from a very strong belief, and I know it's shared widely, that the chief cornerstone of democracy is, in fact, participation. And I think that's the single greatest attribute of this bill, is it gives those parties that are not affiliated with the major parties, Republican or Democrat, a voice in the process and a reason to become engaged and have a greater likelihood of voting in the election. So there are other things that for me would be minor in nature or reasons to support this bill, but the fact that it extends that opportunity for participation, which is fundamental to democracy. Without it, we have no system. So that's why I am here to support it and would encourage your support as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair and colleagues.
Any questions for you? Senator Ferriola, you look like you have a question.
I have a question, Mr. Chair, for any of the panel members. Is there anything that would prevent a candidate from listing an endorsement from any of the political parties in the voter's pamphlet?
Not that I know of.
My understanding is no. There would not be anything that would prohibit that. You can include information in the voter's pamphlet as long as it is accurate information and you swear by it.
The Deputy Secretary of State is sitting back there, and I think what he is saying is, since you're indicating an indication of support from a party, and I'm using that term broadly, you would have to have a statement of endorsement from that party.
That was my point, Mr. Chair, that we currently have a mechanism that requires a statement of endorsement to be filed for anyone who claims an endorsement. But there is a mechanism for any political candidate to list any of the endorsements, not limited to three, already in the current statute available in the voter's pamphlet. Just thought I'd point that out for the record, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any additional questions?
Nope.
Representative Berger, did you have any statement that you wanted to make?
Only, Mr. Chair, Senator Ferrioli, that this is the ballot, and there are people, believe it or not, who don't read the voter's pamphlet.
Mr. Chairman, there are apparently people who can't find a stamp also.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I don't know how much it is.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Next, again, we're still in hearing for 2414. I will call Senator Walker and Senator Boquist.
Okay.
We think this is pretty funny, Mr. Chair. Senator Walker, District 7, we feel like second stringers. And Senator Boquist was telling me that he introduced this bill twice in the House. So I'll let him share that story. I want to hear from the citizens. So
Senator Walker, could you please identify yourself?
I thought I did. Vicki Walker. Yeah. I did, right at the beginning. I'm very good about that, but thank you. I want to hear from the citizens. But what I have to tell you is I think this is pretty cool that the county clerks don't object. It's pretty hard to get those folks in agreement. And I think they will admit that. It doesn't cost anything. And needless to say, the most important piece, the Secretary of State doesn't object. So I love information. I like information being given to the people as frequently as we can. And you passed out Senator Metzger's bill just the other day to fix the wrong that I voted for with regard to independent voters. And it was one of the worst votes I ever took in this building and freely admitted that. So I want to open up the process. As Representative Berger said, people don't belong to either of the two major parties. We are a freewheeling state. We have a lot of different interests in the state, but they shouldn't be shut out of the political process. So I like this bill, as it appears a number of my colleagues do. So, Senator Boquist.
Great. Thank you, Senator. For the record, Senator Brian Boquist, and twice as Representative Boquist. Of course, I'm going to use it against you, Vice Chair. I was a co-sponsor of this bill on the House side, and in both cases, it didn't get completely out of the legislative process. Representative Tom Butler told me one time it took him, he spent eight terms over there, and it took him eight times to get one of his bills out. I was lucky to get my cigarette bill out on the second time because the governor sponsored it. So I'm hoping third time's a charm here when we get this out. What we're really doing is we're identifying in two places. Good Senator Ferrioli made mention that you can put it in the voter's pamphlet. What you can put in the voter's pamphlet is an endorsement statement, as long as you have the form from the Secretary of State's office in the signed, documented, so on and so forth. More of that bureaucratic paperwork. The second place, though, a picture is worth a thousand words, is when the ballot comes out. And if you look on the ballot, that's what we're talking about here, is it will list the party that actually nominated. And I think you can do all kinds of different scenarios out there. There's a lot of people who are always concerned that this might give one party an advantage over the next party. And I think really what it does is it allows participation. It gets the minor parties involved. And in many cases, I mean, we had one this last time around in which there was no major party candidate who could have been endorsed by a minor party in a statewide election. So it goes both directions. And, you know, my key issue here is the more people we get involved, the more people we get in the discussion, the more bipartisan of a political process we have, and the more we will hear from constituents. I think most of us hear from those people we know from our parties, and we hear from those people who don't like us from the opposing party, and in many cases the rest of the parties, minor parties, feel like they're shut out so they don't contact us. And I think this is a good flow of open communications that would benefit the entire state. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, yes. I'd like to respond to Senator Ferrioli's comment about the endorsement. You can put the endorsement in the voter's pamphlet, but you cannot put a nomination in the voter's pamphlet. So that is the difference, and I think Mr. Peralta will testify and talk about that in more detail.
Okay. Any questions for Senator Walker or Senator Boquist? Seeing none, thank you both very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And not to confuse the people here, but I'm going to close the hearing on 2414, open hearing on 2386. Could the committee administrator give a brief overview and also talk to one of the amendments that's going to be offered?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2386A directs Secretary of State to adopt electronic voter registration system. We have the -A3 amendment in front of you, which adds driver's permit to list of valid identification and changes operative date for electronic voter registration system. You'll find another amendment in your packet, but the sponsor of that amendment is here to talk about that amendment. And then you will also find testimony in support of the BIT measure from Disability Rights of Oregon.
Okay. And the hearing has been opened. I'll call up Representative Thatcher, Representative Cannon, and Representative Smith.
Good
and he was here, but Representative Thatcher, why don't you begin, because you're off, you have the amendment, or let's see, maybe.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I have an amendment for a bill that hasn't really been totally described yet. I just handed the sponsors of the bill an amendment. It's not a gut. It is just an addition to...
Representative Thatcher.
Oh, I'm sorry. I haven't identified myself. Yes. I'm Kim Thatcher, and I represent Kaiser, St. Paul, and Newburgh, and I'm a state representative. And what I have is just a simple addition to the bill. It basically says that first-time voters must provide some proof of identification when they register to vote in Oregon. The types of documents that would be acceptable include birth certificates, passports, citizen documents, other documents with a photo ID issued by a government agency. There's wide latitude in the bill for the Secretary of State to adopt rules to spell out other acceptable documents and the methods for providing this documentation. I have been approached to serve on a special committee to work on implementation of Help America Vote Act, and I spent the last 4 years on the Elections and Rules Committees in the House. Under current HAVA law, voters are required to provide identifying information to register to vote, either an Oregon driver's license or ID, or the last four digits of one's Social Security number. And there are provisions for people who don't have those forms of ID and all the information for how to deal with that is on the State Elections Division's website, and the whole voter registration form you can download from their website. Here's the catch. This HAVA requirement only applies to federal elections, and if you don't provide proof of ID when you register to vote, your ballot is flagged in the centralized voter registration system. You can't vote in a federal election, and your ballot isn't counted for those races, and it's only counted for state races and ballot measures. So we kind of have a bifurcated system. You would be able to vote on one hand but not on the other, and your ballot might have to get duplicated, and whatever you voted in a federal election would be not included in that duplication. I heard stories also from last election, volunteers doing calls to voters, and one of them said, "Is Mr. Smith there?" That wasn't the name, but just for demonstration purposes. And the person answering the phone said, "Yes, that's my cat. I registered him to vote to see if I can get away with it, and apparently I did." There's a growing movement across the country to crack down on voter fraud and to enhance the integrity of the system by requiring voter ID. 24 states now have that requirement before they allow people to cast ballots. Oregon doesn't have the polls anymore, and people in other states would show up at the polls to show their ID. This would simply ask for them to provide that when they first sign up to vote. There are 31 states that now offer some form of early voting in the weeks leading up to elections. Obviously, we are one of them. To say who, there are some who might say that this would make it more difficult for people to vote, and I would say this, that this bill already requires essentially that voters get identified through DMV records, et cetera, and HAVA also does require voter ID for federal elections, so this is just would extend it for state elections. Voting is one of the most sacred democratic practices in our country. We have no problem flashing our ID when it comes to cashing a check or renting a video, and we should be proud to participate in a system, in a process that includes security safeguards and measures to protect our ID and ensure our ballot is properly counted. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Thatcher. Representative Cannon Smith, start wherever you want to.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Ben Cannon, State Representative, House District 46. First of all, this is not a bill, as introduced and as it's come to you, that is principally about voter identification or identification requirements. It is a bill about expanding participation in our voting system by creating a secure, safe system for online voter registration. And I want to be really clear when we talk about online voting anything, in just to be extremely clear, this is about online voter registration, not online voting. You heard from Senator Morse earlier that the chief cornerstone for democracy is participation, and I could not agree with him more. And this bill really is about extending participation in our voter system, in our system, by allowing, creating an option for online voter registration. The idea is not novel. Several states have done this already. When we began the process a year ago, Washington and Arizona were using online voter registration systems, in Arizona's case, for a number of years. Since we've had our first hearing on the bill in House rules several months ago, two more states, California and Utah, have adopted systems of online voter registration. We have fiscal support to do this from the Help America Vote Act, and I think you'll hear from the folks in the Secretary of State's office who can tell you more about how this would be implemented using those funds. We have a group of supporters that includes League of Women Voters, Disability Rights Council, ASVSEIU, Oregon Student Association, Osberg Bus Project, Democracy Reform Oregon, and I am told the chief clerks. It's very exciting. And I would encourage you to move the bill along. I'll let my colleague, Representative Smith, say a few more words. I would note, given the fiscal, we're hoping that you will be able to get the Ways and Means, that you'll be able to rescind the Ways and Means referral. I think, given at least the way that we approach this in the House, it's unnecessary. But again, I'll leave that to you and your conversations with others who can go more into the fiscal details behind the bill.
Okay. Thanks. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Jefferson Smith, for the record, representing District 47 in the House. In 2004, Oregon had the largest gap in the nation between turnout among older voters and younger voters. We were worst, tied with Kansas, for that gap. It was 28%. In this last election, there was significant shrinkage of that gap, or significant growth in participation, which is good news, but that gap was still double digits, and there is a lot of work to be done. Most of the analysis that I have seen, in fact, all of the analysis that has considered both questions, has demonstrated that Oregon has not been shown to have a fraud problem in any significant measurable way, in part probably because any campaign that engaged in fraud then being discovered would lose. Any candidate who participated in it would never be able to run again. And any person who participated in it would suffer significant criminal, not just civil penalties. This state does have and has had a participation problem. And it is to that participation problem that I want to address my not very many more words. It is my hope that across party lines we can help Oregon lead the nation in voter access and secure hassle-free voting. This bill in particular, I think, is one that is ripe for that bipartisan support, not only because it was pioneered in significant part by Republican Secretary of State in Washington, Reed, I believe that's his name, yes, but also because many of the benefits of the bill would accrue to those places that aren't as near a county elections office, and those happen to be in districts further away from large urban centers, and thus the benefits from this, we have been told, might not yield to, or not might not accrue to, let's say, my political party. But if we can be together on the principle that Oregon should lead the nation in voter access and in secure, hassle-free voting, then this is a good thing. And I'll leave some of the next generation stuff to people who will testify later, but more and more we are moving to online comfort. We are comfortable now paying bills online and keeping fraud, relatively speaking, down there, and that is without as much Secretary of State participation as would exist here. So I think we could address the costs. Secretary of State's office is committed to do that, and the benefits, I think, could be significant. We're one of the few states that would be there. I would look to the Washington State model as something in terms of implementation. Beyond that, there's lots more I could say, but also could be less, and I really appreciate the committee's consideration of the matter, and we can leave to the several people I know are testifying later.
Any questions for Representative Cannon, Representative Smith, or Representative Thatcher? Yes, Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Either one of you, who'd like to respond. I was curious about the point brought up by Representative Thatcher, and I'll just preface this by saying I support the online program that you have, is that for online you're requiring that someone have a driver's license and actually give permission to have DMV provide that and their signature. And as you know, under House Bill 1080, we are now making secure driver's license, so all that makes sense. But as to Representative Thatcher's amendment, which says, which is the way at least I read it, is that that same requirement should at least be implied to those who register in person. So in other words, online you have to provide it, but you don't necessarily have to do that when you do it in person. What would be your objection to having that same requirement for any registration for voting?
I'll take a shot at it. I mean, the way that we came at the ODOT piece of this, the driver's license requirement or the record on file at the Division of Motor Vehicles, was some need to meet the signature requirement for an online, for a registration, for a voter registration. And obviously, if you are registering to vote online, there's no way, or at least not easily, of actually submitting your signature. And so my understanding is that the reason for the hookup with DMV is to pull that signature. Now, as you've noted, that signature is accompanied by a records check. Does this person have a driver's license on file or a permit or a identification card? But in my view, the principal need here was to import the signature that would attest to the person who's online, sitting there online, who's already attested to be a citizen of the U.S. and at least 18 years old, but also being who they say they are and being willing to affix a signature that's been imported from DMV. So that's where we got that. It just so happens, to those who are worried about the security of the system, there are these additional safeguards as well.
If I might, Mr. Chair,
yes.
Senator Metzger, I'd offer a couple thoughts. That might be the most important one. I might offer a couple others. The first is that I would guess we'd want relatively vigorous discussion, not as an amendment. I mean, maybe other people have seen this amendment before now. I this is the first time I even heard about it, and I'm active in this issue as much as maybe anybody in the state. So so I would think that the proper degrees of where IDs are required, what those IDs are, my guess is we'd want an active conversation about this discrete particular issue. That'd be my first response. My second, some of it, I must admit, is a question about priority, is a question about when, if we share a notion around a secure, hassle-free voting system that maximizes voter access and makes sure it's clean, do we want to have the funnel shaped this way, or do we want to have the funnel shaped the other way? Do we want to have the barriers at the very front end before you even can go in, or do we want to make sure the penalties are the back end so people don't cheat? Having watched lots of voter registration drives, which I know some people would like to get rid of, maybe because they're worried about fraud or maybe because they want certain folks to vote less, right? And I will argue that too much of this debate on yay or nay is based on a strategic calculation about what side or what friend will be benefited or hurt based on the rules we provide. And to me, we should be as much as possible crafting our rules based on maximizing participation, because that will not only benefit, I don't think that benefits one party or the other, but I do think it benefits democracy. So for me, have the penalties stiff, address problems where there really are problems. We haven't seen significant problems around voter fraud. We just haven't seen significant ones that have impacted elections, that have made people win or lose, because when there are the few that happen, we see significant press, we see significant penalties, there are significant criminal penalties, and I think that keeps our election system as clean as just about any in the country. And so that leaves us free to, as this bill does, make sure we're addressing any fraud concerns and really address the access concern. And let me just finish by saying that I do think it's a fair conversation about should there be voter registration drives out in the world, right? I think there should. If somebody's going to say they shouldn't, I think we ought to have a really vigorous debate about it. Should we, as Colorado did, who moved by some people, frankly, who wanted to reduce voter turnout a little bit, should we make people get deputized and go through some training, et cetera, which significantly reduced the number of people participating because it made it harder to do volunteer-driven projects, et cetera. Should we do that? Maybe, but that's something we should have a very vigorous conversation about that should involve both chambers, et cetera, et cetera.
Any additional questions? May I follow up, Mr. Chair?
Senator Mitzel.
Well, I appreciate those comments, and I agree with you, Representative Smith. I, in my own research and hearing comments, have not found significant voter fraud issues. But I'm talking basically more on an equal footing basis, because I think the way you've written your legislation is proper, and that is we don't have the signature, we want the driver's license number so we can compare it. But then, you know, the issue of saying if I'm doing it in person, it's just as easy for me to whip my driver's license out, you know, and do the same thing when I'm registering here that I would be required online. Mm-hmm. And I'm just saying is that if, why would we treat them differently, and these are for people who are registering for the first time, is to be able to, let me check, see your signature and do that. I just, when people would ask, why would you treat people online differently, I just want to know what that answer is.
Let me, and I'll turn it over to Representative Cannon or somebody else if they have, but I can offer one answer.
Representative Smith, please offer the answer, but I want to actually start to get to the members of the public here, too, who have come to testify, but please offer it.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we testify in court, we aver to telling the truth. We raise a hand. We have our face there and our voice there, and therefore we're allowed to say stuff. We're allowed greater leeway what we're allowed to say because we're there in person and we say, I'm here, I'm me, I'm doing this, than we would if somebody just submitted a piece of paper, right? The spoken word is given more validity. I think there is some by nature security offered by the fact that somebody's got to be there, say, yes, this is me, say to another human being, to their face, this is me, I'm going to sign here that it's me, this is my everything, than somebody who's in their house, on a computer, etc. And so I think you could imagine different treatment. But maybe the best answer is the one that Representative Cannon gave. This was an easy thing to deal with the online version because we already had the motor vehicle records and we already had to satisfy that requirement.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative.
Any additional questions,
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thanks, Senator Farrell.
Actually, this is a reaction to Representative Smith's comment about the funnel. Department of Motor Vehicles became the object of fairly intense scrutiny in the legislation that we passed in 07 about new requirements for identification, driver's license issuance, was really driven by the fact that we knew there were more than 85,000 fraudulent driver's licenses that had been issued out the front door of the Oregon Department of Motor Vehicles. We now have achieved a sense of security, which may be a sense of security only, that driver's licenses are being issued to the people whose applications are being verified and who they say they are. But I think it's fair to say that was a reaction to the point that it wasn't a funnel, it was a sieve, and that, you know, there was a lot of fraud going on at the Department of Motor Vehicles, document fraud, and that there's no indication that those 85,000 licenses aren't still out there floating around, or that those signatures, at least a portion of them, aren't still on file at the Department of Motor Vehicles. Wouldn't it be reasonable then to put the same sort of safeguards to first-time registrants that we would with to driver's licenses, which is another way of asking the same question that the senator asked?
Yeah. Either anyone respond if you choose to.
So, a couple thoughts. First, my own hunch is that the comfort level of this committee and the remaining legislators in the building is significantly impacted by the work that was done in the last session. My guess is this particular, even the details of this bill were impacted by that. And that somebody's comfort level with this bill might be relatively well linked to your comfort level of what was done in the last session. If you feel relatively comfortable with that, then I would think that would militate in favor of being somewhat comfortable with this. The second thing I'd say is I'm not sure I understand. Well, I don't know that the link between what the DMV is doing it can be well made to what's happening out in the world. In the voter registration context. And I just don't think that case has been made. But if I were going to try to make the opposite case, I think I could win by making not very many arguments, but one is there's a financial reason to get a driver's license, and there's been a lot of people to do that. I wish we had a problem of people working so hard to vote that occasionally they got it wrong. I wish that people were so clamoring to get a ballot in their hand and cast it that they occasionally were overzealous. That is not the problem we've got. The problem we've got is not enough zeal. The problem we've got is not enough energy. So I don't anticipate, because of this bill, certainly, based on what happened in the last session, having to revisit that. And I think that if we think because of DMV problems, we got to deal with some problems in another sphere, that might be the subject of another bill. And that's a worthwhile conversation to have. But I also think that we should identify the problems that really exist, which has more to do with voter access than otherwise.
Mr. Chair, I just have 4 points,
yes,
real quick. First, you know, voter fraud doesn't come up a lot here in the state, but you have to remember there's nobody checking. There aren't any polls. It requires neighbor telling on neighbor. I mean, there is no check other than, gee, did it make it to their address, and does the signature match on the screen? Doesn't mean that person is a real person. It just means the signature matches. Okay, and we also know, time and again, if you hear about fraud in elections, it's usually from absentee balloting, and that's what we have here in the state. And we also need to bring in some consistency between state or federal requirements to have some sort of ID and state requirements, and that's all this would do. Thank you.
Okay. Any additional questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also believe that the penalties for voter fraud are severe and that it probably doesn't happen very much, like bank robbery. Penalties are severe, it doesn't happen very much, but people still rob banks. We like to believe that voter fraud doesn't happen very much in Oregon, but as Representative Thatcher said, nobody's really checking for it because it doesn't happen very much. I'll just point out that the persistent stories about the number of voters in King County who cast their ballots exceeded the number of voters in King County who were registered to vote by a significant margin. So it isn't that voter fraud doesn't happen. It happens where I think where people are looking, they would find it. But I don't think anybody's looking very hard for it in Oregon. Mr. Chairman, I don't have any questions.
Okay. Seeing, thank you all very much. Thank you, Representative Thatcher.
Thank
you,
Seattle, really. Okay.
I'm going to close the public hearing on HB 2386, reopen the hearing on 2414. And I'll call Barry Pack, Sal Peralto, and Linda Williams forward. And while they're coming forward, for the audience, while they're coming forward, I think that's the most members of the legislature I've ever had come before a committee at one time. That was 9 members of the legislature, 1/10 of the legislature. You may have had more.
Mr. Chair, I was actually asked to testify in support of this because you see I'm on the bill, but because there were so many other people, I decided not to.
Okay. Mr. Pack, if you could start whenever you would like.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Barry Pack, Deputy Secretary of State, and I'm surprised there wasn't a quorum earlier of some committee somewhere. I'm sure the Chief Clerk and the Secretary of the Senate were watching closely. I'll keep my comments on this brief. I think the sponsors of the bill who spoke earlier covered many of the points. Senator Walker in particular mentioned some of the points I wanted to cover. The Secretary of State's office does support this bill. We think that more information to voters as they're making their decisions is a good thing. And like it or not, party affiliation and nomination by a party, not just endorsement, is an important cue for voters when they're evaluating a candidate as to whether or not their particular political philosophy matches with that voter's. And so providing that information up front on the ballot is an important thing. We have seen an increase in the rise of number of minor parties that want to nominate candidates of a major party or another minor party that may be running for a particular office or another, and we've seen an increase in the number of candidates who want to accept those nominations, and so this seems like a reasonable way to provide that information to voters on their ballot when they're making a decision. And as Representative Berger pointed out to you, the candidate who is running does not have to accept that nomination, does not have to have it on the ballot if they did not want to or felt like it wasn't important to them.
Question, Mr. Chairman. Okay. Should we go through the three and then we'll go questions?
This is specifically for the Deputy Secretary.
Okay. Please proceed.
Can a major party candidate refuse to accept a major party nomination?
Mr. Chair, Senator Farioli, yes, you can actually withdraw a nomination. For instance, if you were to be running in your primary and receive the Republican nomination for which you filed, but also received a Democratic nomination by write-in, you don't have to accept that Democratic Party nomination. You can withdraw it or refuse to accept it.
A clarification, Mr. Chairman. I guess my question was, could a candidate receive a nomination of any number of parties and run without any affiliation listed on the ballot?
Chair Devlin, Senator Farioli, no, I believe you do have to have at least one party nomination on the ballot.
Clarification,
Mr. Did I mishear the questions?
No, I think you answered the question.
Yeah, but in terms of... Okay. But in the general election, obviously, you could be a non-affiliated candidate and be on the ballot.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes.
Okay.
But wait a second.
Wait, no.
Mr. Chair, there's a problem here, because if you declined all your nominations... then under our sore loser law, you're not allowed to get on in any other way. So, Senator Farioli, I would recommend that you just hang in there as a Republican, as difficult as it may be.
Well, Madam Chairman, I'm perfectly happy to hang in as a Republican nominee and as a Democrat nominee for my district. But the question is whether or not we're setting up a situation where we might have some candidates who would rather run without those designations and allow voters to wonder.
Well, I've got a lot of people to testify, but Mr. Pence, can you clarify?
Mr. Chair,
if we are talking about the general election, somebody can, by signature, get on the ballot as what we used to refer to as an independent candidate. I think we still do refer to them as an independent candidate. Isn't that true?
I'm not sure.
I mean, that's what we just did. That's what,
Mr. Chair, I think that part of my confusion comes from when you are talking about both partisan offices and nonpartisan offices. And to run for a partisan office,
right,
you accept a party's nomination for that office. If you are running for a nonpartisan office, you don't have to have any particular party affiliation.
Okay. We will move on. Any additional, Senator Farioli?
No, Mr. Chairman, we've been off in the weeds enough on this.
Okay. Mr. Peralto, please proceed and identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Devlin. My name is Sal Peralta. I'm the Secretary of the Independent Party of Oregon, and I'm here today to offer testimony in favor of House Bill 2414. Before I regale you with my prepared remarks, I'd like to just speak to Senator Farioli's point. If I understood you, sir, you were suggesting, can a candidate withdraw the nomination of a party of which they are a member? Could you, Senator Farioli, under this bill, withdraw your Republican nomination and still be the Republican candidate? And the answer to that is no, you cannot. What this bill does is it allows people who receive the cross nomination, meaning the nomination of a party of which they are not a member, to choose which of those nominations to have appear on the ballot. Does that get to your point, sir?
Mr. Chairman, there's endless permutations here. There's three variables and one candidate. I guess what I'd be asking is if a candidate had a minor party nomination and a major party nomination, could the candidate run only on the minor party nomination?
No, sir.
I've got heads going yes and yours going no.
We've not without withdrawing the major party nomination, as long as that major party is a party of which they're a member. And here the statute is pretty straightforward. A candidate of the party of which they are a member under the current statute has to appear as a candidate of that party on the ballot or withdraw the nomination.
It's not withdrawing the nomination. It's a difference between declining the nomination and choosing the names.
Okay. So with that,
Mr. Chairman, may I suggest that we refer to this as the party of the first part, the party of the second part, and the party of the third part?
Can I suggest that we will get some clarification on this issue if we need to in the future, but for today, because I have so many people signed up to testify on this bill and the next bill, we will just proceed with testimony.
Thank you.
Mr. Peralto, please proceed.
This bill is a reasonable reform that will allow candidates who are nominated by more than one party or cross-nominated to list the names of up to three nominating parties on the general election ballot. It also instructs the Secretary of State to present to the legislature recommendations for further action prior to the next legislative session. The bill has no fiscal or revenue impact and is offered as a compromise proposal that addresses the concerns of organizations that have debated this matter in the last three legislative sessions. Oregon has allowed political parties to cross-nominate candidates for the entire history of the state. Sylvester Penaier was elected governor as a candidate of the Democratic Party and the People's Party in 1886 and again in 1890. And during the early part of the 20th century, these cross nominations were common in legislative races. From statehood through 1958, these cross nominations were printed on the Oregon ballot. In 1958, the law was changed to allow only one nominating party to be listed for each candidate. In 1995, the law was changed again, we believe, to allow up to two parties to be listed on the ballot in certain circumstances. The previous Secretary of State disagreed with that interpretation, and the matter is currently under appeal in state court. We appear to you today offering this bill as a clarification of existing law and that will settle this disagreement to the full satisfaction of all parties involved in that dispute. The bill, as it has been mentioned, has the support of the Secretary of State and the county clerks, who have verified that its provisions can be accommodated on existing software in all 36 counties and that the cost of administering the system can be absorbed into existing budgets. The bill has strong bipartisan support from 13 Senate co-sponsors, 8 Democrats, 5 Republicans, and I'm deeply grateful to the senators who have spoken here today on behalf of the bill. I think their testimony is a tribute to the sense of fairness and public interest goodwill that exists in this body. The purpose of this reform is to bring more of Oregon's minor political parties and their 100,000 members into the political mainstream and to encourage and reward greater collaboration between minor political parties and major party candidates in advancement of their common interests. One of the concerns that I've heard raised about this proposal is whether or not it'll be used by minor political parties to take positions in races solely for the purpose of raising their profile. I want to make it clear that qualified minor parties already have the ability to nominate candidates under these circumstances or any other. The real question before this committee is whether or not you believe that the only role available to minor parties should be that of spoiler, running candidates to the right or the left of the major party candidates with the purpose of throwing races to one side or the other, or whether this committee will also see the wisdom in encouraging minor political parties to collaborate with candidates of the major parties with whom they share common interests. There are several substantive reasons why this reform is needed. First, it brings Oregon law into greater agreement with federal law as it relates to the formation of federally recognized state party committees. Second, the reform provides voters with more accurate information about the affiliations and interests of candidates for public office. In 2008, the Independent Party of Oregon spent a significant amount of money sending mailers out in support of our cross-nominated legislative candidates. However, the fact that these candidates were not listed on the ballot or in the voters' pamphlet as candidates of the Independent Party of Oregon may have led to confusion on the part of voters who could not ascertain from any document provided by the state the relationship between the party and its candidates. Third, it will likely reduce confusion on the part of those who seek to administer our elections. In 2008, Joel Haugen, who won the Republican nomination in the 1st Congressional District with more than 70% of the vote, was forced to withdraw his Republican nomination in order to appear on the ballot as a candidate of the Independent Party of Oregon. This resulted in a $43,000 cost to the state when the Elections Division erroneously listed him as a Republican nominee in the voter's pamphlet. Finally, I'm reminded of a comment by you, Senator Farioli, that you made during the 2008 interim session in which you said we should put all meaningful voters information in front of voters and trust them to make up their own minds. I agree wholeheartedly with that statement, and that is what this bill is about. Every major party candidate who was cross-nominated by both the Independent Party and the Working Families Party of Oregon wanted those nominations to appear on the ballot, and House Bill 2414 gives candidates the freedom to choose what cross-nominations to print. I urge the committee to send House Bill 2414 to the floor. Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Williams.
Thank you, Chairman Devlin and members of the committee. I'm Linda Williams. I'm Portland, Oregon attorney, and I am a state officer of the Independent Party. And a fair portion of my practice in Oregon is federal and state elections law. So I have to constrain myself from jumping in a couple of times during the earlier comments. I also want to thank previous members of the legislature who testified, and the county clerks who worked quite diligently to produce sort of a sample ballot so it could be visually shown to folks just what it would look like to have several nominations appear on the ballot. I think most of the points that I cover in my written testimony have been well represented and spoken to by the previous speakers. I would like to just emphasize a couple of points, unfortunately, of law. The question about the federal election statute, I try to explain at page 3 of my testimony, and that primarily mean the Federal Elections Commission, if you're running a federal candidate, requires that to be recognized as a state party committee for the purposes of federal election, being able to support a candidate with money and finances lawfully in a federal election, the nominating party has to be recognized under federal law as a state party committee. And one of the details that they look to in their definition of a state party committee is that not only are you a party under state law and you've not had a nominating process and nominated someone for a federal office, but your party name has to appear with the candidate's name. So, for example, the Independent Party cross-nominated Senator candidate Jeff Merkley, and we were unable to obtain state party committee status in order to spend money lawfully and collect money lawfully and expend money on literature for the federal candidate because of this way that Oregon law, by not allowing the Independent Party name to appear on the ballot with Mr. Merkley, worked, I think, to a disadvantage that was never intended. So if the Working Families Party, the Greens, whatever, were to cross-nominate a federal candidate, they would be able to gain party recognition through an advice opinion letter process at the Federal Elections Commission. And I mention that because I spent quite a bit of time on the phone with the Federal Election Commission General Counsel trying to work through this problem, which was not resolved at the time of the election. A second point, the majority of my testimony, pages 4, 5, 6 through the end, through 8, lay out the historical language as the statute has evolved. And as Mr. Peralta pointed out, historically, in fact, initially for most of Oregon's statehood, any number of parties could appear on the ballot. The only limit was they couldn't be more than three words long, so they could have a number of fairly short named parties appear on the ballot. And we think that that historical and inclusive tradition overlapped with a particularly important and stimulating time in the development of political parties and political ideas, as ideas were generated by minor parties and political movements and then became part of the big tents of the two major parties that eventually became the major parties. I would like, if possible, when the chair or staff of the committee seeks further clarification, I'd like to just make a couple of points that will guide perhaps the questions that are asked either of legislative counsel or of staff. For example, there is Senator Farioli mentioned the voter's pamphlet, and by rule, the Secretary of State is implementing the design of the candidate page or half page in the voter's pamphlet by implementing it in the same way that the Secretary in the past has implemented what we think is incorrectly the ballot design. That is, on the state-designed part of the voter's pamphlet where the candidate's picture appears and the office appears, that is the only place that you actually see the political party identifier next to the name in big type or bigger type and next to the picture. And that is a state designed and state sanctioned forum where the state thinks that it is particularly important to clearly identify that person as a political party nominee. If the candidate had gotten on the ballot through the petition process and not through a political party nomination process, the state Secretary of State would have then play in that position at the top of the voters pamphlet would say non-affiliated or a non-affiliated candidate, because that's the terminology that used now for the petitioned candidates. So there's a tremendous difference between the importance and the prominence that the state gives the party nominations as opposed to the endorsements, which are really statements of approval that any association or person has the right as a freedom of expression, and they can be listed as the candidate chooses after going through the proper paperwork. But there's certainly a great difference between the prominence and the importance of a political party, the basic formation principles of which have to do with running candidates and espousing political points of view that are critically important to other parts of our First Amendment rights, not just the freedom to say who you endorse, but the freedoms to participate in political associations. And it's that prominence to political parties, as opposed to other groups of loosely organized individuals or individuals who may wish to endorse, that we're speaking to. And so that's really the difference between the voters pamphlet endorsement and the political party nomination process.
Ms. Williams, could you please conclude your testimony?
Okay. When you seek clarification on the ballot design, it would be helpful to understand the difference between withdrawing from the nomination of a party, which means that you either reject the nomination, so you no longer accept, or you withdraw and the party has an opportunity to nominate someone else, and exercising the affirmative choice of choosing which party nominations will appear on the ballot. So I hope I've made that point clear, that there's a difference between withdrawing, which is the process of not being the candidate at all, and the affirmative process of choosing to identify among the parties which have nominated you and which you have accepted, which is a legal status that's Secretary of State rules, and what appears, and which names you choose to have appear on the ballot, up to three under this bill.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Thank you all very much. Given the number of people that still have to testify on this bill and the other bill that I have to bring back up for hearing, we will ask everyone to please stay within 3 minutes. Barbara Dudley and Bruce Kronk.
How many people are left?
Are you still here? Okay, please come forward.
Unfortunately, yes.
And then after that will be Elizabeth Kushwa and Sherry Harris.
Thank you, Chair Devlin, and Senators, thank you for having this hearing, for staying here way after hours. My name is Barbara Dudley. I'm an adjunct professor at the Hatfield School at Portland State. I'm also a partner in Bethel Heights Vineyard, a family farm in Polk County, my family. And I am co-chair, relevant to this conversation, of the Oregon Working Families Party. I'm here to speak in favor of HB 2414. The Working Families Party has, for the last two legislative sessions, supported legislation to restore fusion voting in Oregon. Those bills called for cross nominations of a candidate to be listed on the ballot on separate party lines, with the voter choosing the party as well as the candidate. We were unsuccessful in moving a fusion voting bill in either 2007 or 2008, in large part because of concerns about possible costs and adjustments to the voting software. While we do not think such costs would be significant, we realized that if we were to move forward toward opening up the ballot to cross nominations, we needed to support a compromise measure, and HB 2414 is that compromise. It is one that supported the county clerks as well as the Secretary of State and is co-sponsored by some 13 members of this chamber. It passed the House by a vote of 53-7. HB 2414 is not fusion voting in that it does not provide for separate party nominations of a candidate to appear on separate lines in the ballot. It simply provides that when the candidate's name is listed on the ballot, after his or her name the various party nominations that the candidate has received and accepted are listed with that person's name. In our opinion, this bill is a small but very significant electoral reform. While under current law, legislative candidates may accept multiple nominations, the law has been interpreted to allow only one such nomination to actually appear on the ballot. We believe that practice discriminates against the voter, the candidate, and the political parties. The voter has a right to know if a candidate has won and accepted the nomination of more than one party. The candidate has a right to demonstrate broad support to the voter, and the parties have the right to nominate any eligible candidate, and if that nomination is accepted, to have that nomination appear on the ballot. Not all minor parties will exercise the option to cross-nominate a major party's candidate, and minor parties, all of them, will undoubtedly continue to run standalone candidates when they think it is appropriate. But the option of cross-nomination means that the possibility of compromise and coalition is available to them. And that option makes it more likely that compromise can be reached in the legislature. When fusion voting was legal in Oregon in the 19th century, it provided a way for rural and urban voters to come together on issues they had in common. Economic issues which affected family farmers, lumbermen, and urban wage earners alike. This is an era when we could very much use that common voice, when rural and urban Oregonians need to come together to find solutions to the issues that plague our state and the country, from budget shortfalls, unemployment, credit freezes, mortgage foreclosures, as well as land use planning and health care reform. The people of this state do not all fit neatly into the two major parties. Over 25% of them are not affiliated with either party, and a significant percentage, as you heard earlier, of the voting age population is not registered to vote at all. Oregon voters can be very thoughtful. They certainly are very opinionated. And yet, under the current system, they can only participate in the electoral process in a consequential way if they vote Republican or Democrat.
If you could please conclude.
I am. Many Oregonians clearly want more choices. They don't want to throw their vote away. They don't want to be spoilers. They want cross-nomination as one possible way to give them an opportunity to participate. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Let's see. Mr. Kronk.
Yes. My name is Bruce Kronk. I live in Roseburg, Oregon. Thank you, Chair Devlin, and the members of the committee for holding this hearing on Bill 2414. That's the fusion voting bill, as I'm sure you've all heard. A little background. I've run in two legislative races as a Democrat, lost twice, once to Susan Morgan in House District 1, and once to Jeff Cruz in Senate District, or Morgan in 2 and Jeff in District 1. You might call me a slow learner. I did learn a few things, though, when I ran for office. First, I noticed that most people don't pay much attention to candidates. The voters that show up at these candidate forums have already made up their minds, and they just attend to show support. Second, most people don't pay much attention to political analysts unless they agree with the person who is writing the analysis. Third, and you probably are familiar with this, I'm extemporizing, sorry. The person with the most money is likely to win. He'll be the person that gets elected, and once elected is hard to beat. Will a cross-nomination change any of this? Actually, it might. If House Bill 2414 becomes law, voters might see that you are nominated by more than one party, and although the hidebound voter will see the R or the D after your name and cast their vote, but some voters, and I'm speaking to the non-affiliated voters because they seem the least likely to vote at all, will take advantage of the added nomination information to actually cast an informed vote. An informed vote. That's what we want.
Might be infirmed, too.
The last fact I'll mention is the effect of major parties and minor parties. Effect on their... I wrote this and I can't even read it. House Bill 2414 will probably have little effect on who's in power and who's not, but I think the ability to cross-nominate candidates will have a much larger effect on third parties who are forced to choose between casting a spoiler vote and electing someone they don't support, or even worse, voting for someone who will take their vote and then ignore them. Third parties who cross-nominate candidates will generally have little incentive to run their own candidates because their party will no longer be frozen out of the system. This version of fusion voting is good for democracy. It will cost virtually nothing to implement. And I'm sure experienced candidates such as yourselves will have no problem figuring out the new political landscape and make yourself a better legislature. Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions?
Any questions? Okay. Ms. Dudley, I've been asked to convey to you that you are Senator Burdick's daughter's favorite teacher.
Thank you. Not only that, but I'm also her constituent.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Kushwa and Ms. Harris. And again, if you could limit your testimony to 3 minutes each.
Good afternoon, Senator Devlin, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Elizabeth Kushwa, and I'm here representing the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, Local 555. And just to want to make my testimony very brief, we are in support of House Bill 2414. The over 16,000 members of the union in Oregon feel strongly about this bill being able to raise participation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Chair Devlin and members of the committee, my name is Cherry Harris. I'm with the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 701. We are a labor union, building trades union of about 4,000 members, most of whom live in the state of Oregon. And so we have a statewide jurisdiction as well as 5.5 counties in southwest Washington. Most of them live in Oregon and their families as well. They cross the entire map of this state from the far reaches of Harney County to Tillamook to southern Oregon to the Portland area. I do a lot of the political work for my union, and so much of my time is spent trying to engage our members in issues and around candidates. And one of the things that I've found in analyzing our membership is that we have a little over a third registered Democrats, about a third registered Republicans, and about a third who are not registered at all. And really, in this two-party system, have a hard time figuring out why they should engage. We are in support of House Bill 2414 because we believe that it gives people information that they don't otherwise have readily at their fingertips when they're filling out their ballots. And it gives them information about where a candidate stands on issues that are important to them. They get fired up about issues. They have a real hard time getting fired up about a Democrat or a Republican, and those are their only choices. Thank you.
Any questions for the panelists? Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on 2414, reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2386, and I'd like to call forward Mr. Dave Franks and Brittany Bonnet, please. You have the right to refuse to testify. Please state your name for the record.
Do you want to go first?
Go ahead.
Oh, thank you. All right. Well, Vice Chair Ferrioli and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brittany Bonnet, and I'm a senior at Tualatin High School, and I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 2386 on behalf of the Oregon Bus Project. During this past election year, I traveled the Portland metro area presenting to my peers about the importance of voter registration and civic engagement. My main goal was to inspire young people to get registered to vote and to be active in democracy. Time and again, I was met with excited people who wanted to register and wanted to help get their friends registered. But whenever I asked them how to do that, the answer was pretty clear. They want to put voter registration online. So a few things that I learned while registering young people was that, first of all, for better or worse, high school students live the majority of their life online. We spend a good deal of time on our computers, on the internet. We do our homework online. We apply for college online. Even the boys in my graduating class, they can register for the selective services online. So the internet is increasingly, you know, our portal to the world, and we would also like it to be the portal to our civic duty. The more that young people in our generation can access the services of our government online, the more we can believe in our government. You know, if it can be as easy for us to register to vote as it is for us to apply for college or to apply for our first jobs, I think that we can bring an entirely new generation into the political process and show that government is something that young people can definitely be a part of. With online voter registration, we can link the registration site to high school websites and you know, other websites that high school students frequent. On top of increased access, I can't, you know, stress enough the importance of the message that online voter registration sends to young people. Many of my peers are intimidated by the voter registration card, if for no other reason that it looks like a standardized test, which can be very intimidating, if not, you know, a little bit dooming. We're not too interested. So if we could give that same, ask those same questions online, for some reason, I think young people would be much more inclined to fill out a form when it just, you know, is right there on the internet. It sounds kind of silly, but I've heard it from a lot of people, including my peers. They say that, you know, the registration form can be a little complicated. It would also show that young people, it would also show to the young people that the government is accessible and it's helpful and it's here for us as much as we want to be here for them. You know, studies have shown that voting is habit forming. We've talked about that already today. And if a young person votes in two consecutive elections, they're much more likely to vote in every election after that. But the first step to that is getting them registered to vote. And I can promise you that online voter registration would increase the youth electorate by a lot. So with that, I urge you to support House Bill 2386 and establish online voter registration here in Oregon. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, yes. The other witness, I think, was cross-nominated. I think Mr. Pack is probably the correspondent. So, oh, you did it. Correct. I see.
Okay. Mr. Franks.
Thank you, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dave Franks. I'm the Centralized Voter Registration and Help America Vote Act Manager for the Secretary of State's office. Mostly I'm here to answer any questions you may have about our plans for implementation of the system and payment of the system. I did provide some written testimony for you regarding the use of federal dollars that we plan to use for the enhancement of our centralized voter registration system to include an online component for registration. I can go into more detail if you'd like, or I think the written testimony hopefully will answer most of your questions.
Okay. Any questions? Please proceed.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, I'll be brief because we have a lot of folks that want to talk, and I also had some dental work just before I got here, so I'll be very brief. We just want to thank the sponsors, particularly...
Can you identify yourself for the record?
I'm sorry. I'm Amy Wilson. I work with the Secretary of State's office. We wanted to thank the sponsors, particularly Representative Cannon. And I just wanted to step back a little bit and clarify kind of how the process will work really quickly for folks. And what this is going to do is... How it is set up online is there are five or six different screens that you go through, and what's different about this is that you have to specify what your eligibility is before moving through the next screen. So it asks you, are you a citizen, are you 18, which is more than what we do on our voter registration card now, and so there's less opportunity for error. It's also because we have the actual voter writing in the information, there's less opportunity for transcription errors. As a state, we do really well with registered turnout, voters that are registered and turnout, but we probably don't do as well with eligible voters and voter registration. That's where we really have some ground to gain. And I just wanted to specify that we had put forth the amendments. One of them lengthens the timeline. We realize that we have a couple of priorities and there are some budget issues, and so we may need a little bit more time to get this going. And the other issue is that it now we did not include permits on the first version. It was an oversight, and because you can register at the age of 17 and because people get permits at all kinds of ages, that we wanted to make sure that that was included and that folks would be able to access driver's license, because they will be in the system and they will have to do their signature and all of the things you'd have to do for a license. With that, I was actually going to be the introduction to Dave, but if there are any, he is our local expert. If there are any logistical questions or anything that would help the committee, that's why we brought him here today.
Any questions? Hearing none. Thank you all very
much. Thank
you. We will go on to, I believe, Hannah Fisher and Kathy Eaton. Please proceed, whoever wants to go first.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Kathy Eaton, the governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. I will be very brief this evening. One of the league's principles is to make voting and voting access as efficient and as simple as possible so that as many people as possible would participate. We very much support House Bill 2386, because we believe it increases the access to the voter registration system. We were very much interested in the House hearings, the young people that were there talking about the importance of encouraging young people to register to vote, and in the technology we have nowadays, that's where they are. So we really encourage you to move forward on House Bill 2386. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Fisher.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, my name is Hannah Fisher, and I am the student body president at Portland State University, and I also sit on the board of directors for the Oregon Student Association and represent over 100,000 students from public post-secondary education across the state. While the manifold benefits of vote by mail are plain to see, there are some drawbacks that receive less attention. Transient populations, such as college students, are challenged by a system that requires a permanent mailing address in order to receive the ballot. We often move at the end of each school year, usually without knowing where we will be at the beginning of the next school year, a situation I know all too well. Freshmen moving into the dorms for the first time must all register and then re-register upon moving off campus. Because ballots cannot be forwarded from previous addresses, and because a little thought is paid to voting over summer vacation, students return to campus each school year with outdated voter registration. In presidential election years, this leaves less than 3 weeks to update in time for November elections. Many miss their chance, thinking that they can just do it online. I have asked hundreds, if not thousands, of students to register to vote on my campus, and one of the most common things I hear is, "I'll just do it online later. Please don't bother me right now." And I have to take time to explain to them that that is not actually an option that we currently have in Oregon, which is confusing for a lot of students because literally everything that we do is online. We even take classes online. Our financial aid is online. We register for classes online. It is confusing for a lot of students to not be able to register to vote online either. Electronic formatting is the norm for us. A voter to not register to vote online is now an abnormality. This is even truer for citizens with disabilities. The move to an online voter registration system can alleviate many obstacles. For example, people with alternative vision abilities
computers on campus as well as their personal computers are outfitted to be able to register to vote without the assistance of someone else. And this is very important for students with disabilities to be able to utilize. So for all of the above reasons, and there are many more, I urge you to please support HB 2386. Thank you.
Any questions for Ms. Eaton or Ms. Fisher? Seeing none, thank you both very much. This will be our final panel coming up. Ms. George F. Mr. Matt Wallace and Ms. Janice Thompson. Please begin.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, thank you for asking me up today, and I'll be very, very brief. I'm Georgette Brown. I'm representing the Oregon Clerks Association, and I just want you to know that the Oregon Clerks Association do approve this bill, and we are very willing to work diligently to make everything successful in this new venture online for the young people, especially on voter registration.
Whoever wants to go next.
Yeah, sure.
For the record, Matt Wallace, consumer advocate with OSPRC. We're the statewide citizens-based public interest advocacy organization. Senator Devlin, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to just briefly weigh in support of 2386A. Mainly just want to echo, I think, especially the comments of the students who shared sort of their personal experience with online voter registration, voter registration efforts and the lack of online voting that's available now, I think really, you know, continues to make the issue hit home to me. The only other two things that I wanted to mention very briefly, and you can look at the written testimony, which hopefully puts the online registration issue in the context of modernizing voter registration more generally. Is, you know, we've looked at it, not only the benefits to getting the vote out via online, but also potential cost savings of doing so. And you can see the numbers in the testimony, but recently did a report in conjunction with our national organization showing significant potential cost savings of really streamlining that process and getting more of it online, called Saving Dollars, Saving Democracy. And then the last thing is that, we have done a lot of extensive efforts on voter registration throughout the years, and one thing we know is that, you know, the trend really is and got to continue to be towards online voting. And we've attempted to sort of get out ahead of that. Last year in 2008, we created a widget online which allowed people to not actually register online, but to at least print out the form in a way that was similar to how it would be if they were able to register online and then actually mail that form in. One of the benefits to that was not only just sort of the ease of use for people using that program by essentially clicking a button on the website, but also helped aid voter registration efforts by allowing us to sort of get that voter registration message out to more people in places where they haven't seen it before, in sort of the online universe where young people especially dwell more frequently. So with that, I'll leave my spoken comments there, and thanks again for the opportunity to weigh in and support.
Hey, Ms. Thompson.
Janice Thompson, Democracy Reformer, Oregon, interested in accessible politics, accountable government. Support the bill. It was very striking during the House hearing to hear from the student testifiers just the extent to which their lives are immediate online. But that actually prompted me to sit down and really think through, like, even I, what am I doing online, even if it's just not quite a second nature? And I think, really, I see this as just an incredibly appropriate use of technology to increase access and security of the registration process. It's just kind of, there's discussions in the building about any number of things moving online, and this is just, I think, part and parcel of that. And it is an indication of Oregon, I think, being a leader, and one example historically is that the state led the nation in the mid-70s in allowing registration by mail. So I think this is just kind of like, this age's technological way to kind of move forward. And, of course, it's great that HAVA funds can pay for it, and just urge your support.
Okay. Any questions for the panel? Seeing none, I will close the public hearing. Thank you very much. Just for the sake of the committee and the people in the audience, 2621 is scheduled for a work session on Friday. 2386 is scheduled for a work session on Friday. I am going to try to clarify the subsequent referral to Ways and Means for 2386. The fact that 2414 is not scheduled for a work session on Friday should not in any way imply what action is going to be taken after this. We're just looking for dates to put things on for public hearings and work sessions. But just to let you know, those two bills will be up Friday. Anything else for the good of the order? Seeing nothing, we are adjourned till 10:30 Friday morning.